Hello and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg. By now you've scanned the headlines on biznews.com or caught the interviews on the channel, but the real story often lives in the margins, the context that doesn't make the press release, the whispers that we pick up after the record button stops, whether it's the shifting sands of geopolitics or the political currents that are shaping our economy. That's what we do here. We strip away the polish to tell you the backstory and why it actually matters. This is the Editor's Desk, exclusive analysis for our premium members. It's Friday, the 27th of February, 2026. Let's take a look behind the curtain. Well, the first place to look is what I've been doing for the last 3 days, or most of the last 3 days anyway. And that was going through to Cape Town for the national budget. And, well, I have been doing this for a long time. In fact, the very first budget that I went to was interesting, talking to Davie Ruert the other day. And Davie mentioned that his first budget, and he's done 41 of them, was with Barent du Plessis. Now, I recall Barent du Plessis being the Minister of Finance when I was a young reporter. And I remember this so well because at an International Monetary Fund meeting, which was about the only international body back then, we're talking about the early 80s, that South Africa was allowed to be a member of. Everything else South Africa had been kicked out of. So as a journalist, you never got to travel internationally excepting to the IMF meeting. And I remember it being a highlight of my young career. I was about 3 or 4 years in when Finance Week and my editor there, Richard Roth, decided to send me to Washington to cover the IMF. I had a dear friend and we remained close friends for many years until he passed away about 12 years ago. My dear friend, Flip Mayer, at the time was claustrophobic. And he could not go into lifts. So the consequence was that he and I walked up 27 floors of stairs. That's why I remember it so well, because he wouldn't go in the lift. And he was my friend, so we did it. We walked together, and I can remember walking up 27 floors, stories, in this hotel building where the IMF was held, to get to the South African delegation to meet with, of course, Barent du Plessis. Anyway, it's funny, those little stories that you remember. But my first budget was actually with Owen Horwood. And why do I remember that? Because I was sitting those days, they didn't have today, which is highly sophisticated, and I'll get into that in a moment, the lockups and the information and so on. You had to go and sit in the gallery and make notes. And of course, what did I know? I'd never even been to Parliament before. But I sat in the public gallery and watched down as Owen Horwood was delivering his budget, and how the members of Parliament, all whites, of course, as it was back in those days, were totally misbehaving themselves and chanting away about how fat cat gnats smoked cigars. Funny how you remember these things, eh? Anyway, that's where my history goes for the budget. And why is the budget so important? Well, it's the national financial results presentation. It's what we as citizens of this country put into the 26% of the economy that is the state. In fact, I think the number's getting closer to 27% now. So it's, but anyway, it's continuing to go up. And the problem that we have here is that that side of the economy is unproductive. So you've got the rest of the economy pays taxes, which go to fund that 27%. And so you need to keep a very close eye on how the taxes are being allocated, and you need to keep a very close eye on how taxes are actually being extracted, because it's from the productive sector of the economy that it's being taken. I never forget this. Those guys in Parliament who wear the red overalls and the fatigues, the military fatigues, are being paid by us. They're not going there because they're adding value. They're going there because they're representing a certain constituency, but they're also being very handsomely paid, and they're being paid by taxpayers. And at some point in time, they need to realize that. South Africa needs to realize that. And Treasury reminds us of this. And in fact, they produce some incredible documentation. It's a lot like South Africa as a whole, where we have got so many laws, which are really good laws. The problem is we just don't implement them. And then we do implement stupid laws that bureaucrats absolutely rely on or believe in or demand, because it keeps their rhythm going, or it keeps their little paper shuffling continuing. And those are things that frustrate the heck out of any private sector person, when you just imagine the wastage that happens through stupid decisions and poorly thought through laws. And I don't want to, I've just gone through one of those things recently, so I don't want to start getting personal about it. But sometimes those in the public service should just re-examine what they're doing and why they're doing it. And it isn't enough to say, well, it's always been done this way. It needs to be, why are we doing it that way? And that brings me to my overriding impression from the few days that I've just spent in Cape Town. And that is that there is a new focus on exactly that point that is coming through this country. Now, it'll happen. It was always going to happen. But I'm delighted to say that it is happening now. And why it was always going to happen was that even governments are subjected to the laws of economics. You can't keep spending on unproductive stuff indefinitely, because those who give you the money to spend are going to say, I'm not giving it to you anymore. Now, South Africa has had a huge capacity to do that because we were well managed during the first decade or so of the new South Africa. There was fiscal disciplines. There was an understanding that the more that you spent, the more you had to borrow. The more you borrowed, the more interest you had to pay. And the more interest you paid, the less money that you had to uplift people, to invest into the economy, to spend that 60 cents in the rand, as we do in this country, on the social wage, as they call it. So there was a very strong appreciation of that. And whenever there was a boom of some sort, the money would be brought in, and instead of it being used to pass out the sweeties, it was used to repay debt. So we got to the point in 2008 after there was a massive commodities boom at that stage. And after 2008, we got to the point where our debt to GDP was down to 26%. Now, that's something that I suppose many people battle to get their heads around. But the important thing was, of all the tax money that was brought in, all the taxes that we as private citizens paid, only eight rand 80 in every 100 rand was paid in interest. Today it's 21 rand. So that will give you an understanding. When we talk debt to GDP ratio of 78%, it's whatever. You know, if it was 178%, would that really be a problem? People don't get that, but this you get. This we all get. We paid 8 rand 80 as a nation of every tax rand that came in 2008. Today we pay 21 rand as a nation on interest. And the big thing about this budget that was repeated time and again was the Treasury is now doing flick-flacks because finally they can see that that has peaked, that the 21 Rand in every 100 Rand of tax that is brought in is going to start falling. And that will release money to be used in other ways. And as a result of that, you can see some injection into economic growth on the one hand and improvement in the social wage on the other hand. On top of all of that, there were, for the first time, there were concrete signals of cutting back on the biggest issue. I remember interviewing John Steenhuisen in Cape Town a few years ago. It was fairly shortly after he'd taken over as the leader of the Democratic Alliance. And I said to him, what happened? What would happen if you actually became the president of the country? Let's just say there was a miracle in the next election and the DA were to be voted into power and you, John Steenhuisen, became the president. He said it would be the most incredibly difficult job because we have such a bloated public sector. And Treasury's been saying the same thing for years and years. It all happened, and here's a bit of joining the dots. It all happened because when the ANC came into power, it was time for their pals to get jobs. So it didn't matter if you had no expertise. You got a job because you'd won the war. You'd been in the struggle. You'd fought the good fight. And that just continued. And once you got your job, then you got onto a union. You made sure you could never lose your job. And actually your union would then twist the arms, the rubber arms of those who they were negotiating with, who were reliant on their votes anyway, or the votes of their members. And as a consequence of that, they enjoyed inflation-beating increases to the degree that we now have millions of public servants who are earning millions or over a million a year. So it's got to a ridiculous situation, and that was the point that John Steenhuisen was making back then. Ever since, I've kept a close eye on this, and in 2020, Tito Mboweni tried to start, and he actually wrote into his budget something like 25 billion rand then, to say that that's what we're going to save by paying out the early retirement for public servants. And he put it onto the into the numbers. Nobody really believed him. And rightly so, because it was a guess, it was a Hail Mary pass, and at that point, public servants said, "No chance am I going to be leaving this cushy job. Why should I? I don't really have to have too much competence." And we're not talking about everybody. Please, there are some excellent public servants, and especially now, in recent times, where the younger group have come through. But back then, those who were approaching retirement primarily didn't have the alternatives elsewhere. It wasn't like, well, you're working in the public service because it's in the national interest, but actually if you leave there, you can earn a lot more in the private sector. Not at all. These people are unemployable outside. So why would they retire? Why would they resign? And this time around, in this budget, a few thousand have actually taken packages. Started to take packages. And then a few thousand more have been identified as having never been employed anyway, what they call ghost workers. So it's that housekeeping that's being addressed. The housekeeping on the ability for South Africans to take money offshore. It's been a million rand for, I don't know, a long time that you could take overseas every year. Now, in one fell swoop, and very quietly because there was so much else going on in the budget, it's been doubled. So now you're allowed your discretionary allowance, the amount of money you can take overseas without telling anybody or asking for permission from exchange control authorities. You have to tell the bank because this has to be monitored for obvious reasons. But that's gone to 2 million. So a couple can take 4 million a year. And effectively, that means the end of exchange control issues for investing offshore. So you can now invest anywhere in the world, pretty much, unless you're super wealthy, I suppose. And it's not going to be a good thing for the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, because more and more South Africans are realizing that for the 300-odd companies that are listed on the JSE, there are 100 times more that are listed elsewhere in the world, who, if you get to know them and you invest in them for the long term, can give you a better return, because they are in countries where the economies are expanding faster than ours here in South Africa. So all of these things put it together was it gave me, when I came home, it gave me a feeling that the more I see the realities of South Africa being played out where it matters, in the numbers rather than in the narrative, the more excited I get about this place I'm just besotted with. And aren't we all? Our thoughtful patriots of the BizNews tribe. I've got three other little stories that I'd like to refer you to, which are on the BizNews back end. And let's start off with one from the Common Sense, Frans Cronje's lot, where he points out, and very interestingly, one of the reporters there points out that the by-election win this week in Bryanston by the Democratic Alliance, the person who won the by-election, B. Campbell Clutty, and she won it with 95% of the vote. So I really cruised home. Back in 2021, the DA candidate only won it with 71% of the vote. So she was already a member of the Joburg Metro Council, but she was a proportional representation member. So this time around, she went and stood as a ward councillor and won, which means her proportional representation seat is now available for the party to appoint whoever they want to. And what the Common Sense are saying, why not Helen Ziller? She's standing for mayor in the next election, that we know, Joburg mayor. Why not appoint her now as a city councillor? And she, because they've got the seat, wouldn't she be the best person to put there? Interesting. They also make the point that Action SA's Sowetan head plus five branch chairmen for Action SA have defected, and another 50 members of the party have moved across to the Democratic Alliance, alleging that Action SA is undemocratic, that it's run from above. Now, this is making it very spicy, the BizNews conference, which is, 10 days away? Because we have Helen Ziller from the Democratic Alliance, who is going to be delivering a keynote, and Herman Mashaba from the leader of Action SA, who is going to be delivering a keynote. And the two of them are taking each other on. They are their party's mayoral candidates for Johannesburg. And now you get this defection from certain Action SA councillors. So it's going to, I think we're going to have to be keeping them to opposite sides of the tent. Or the tents, the marquees, rather. We've got two marquees this year, which is quite cool. But it certainly adds quite a lot of spice. Also spicy is the article that we've run from our partners at The Economist on Anthony Robbins, or now Tony Robbins. He's the most famous life coach on the planet. He's apparently coached 100 million people in his 45-year career. If you've seen, there was a documentary on Netflix that I watched a while ago. He's a high-energy guy, and he packs out stadiums. He's got it's quite a business model that he has, and it gets people really G'd up, and I think he changes their lives, hopefully, and they stay changed. But The Economist, the writer, now The Economist is unusual in that it does not identify its writers. It's looking to change things a little bit there, but for the moment, they're sticking with their policy for the last nearly 200 years. That's the title was started in 1843 and has been built on since then. And that was their policy back then. We don't identify the writers because all writers are giving the view of The Economist overall, which is, it's just a fabulous publication. I know there's some people who say it's gone left and it's gone woke, and no way. Just read it. It's incredibly sensible, and we are so proud to be the only licensee on the African continent. But anyway, this Economist staffer attended a new marketing approach that Anthony Robbins has adopted, which is a free webinar. So attend the webinar for free, and then there are certain little add-ons. You can become a gold card member, where you go to a special area where only 1,000 people can go, and so on. But The Economist writer says this is a change in the approach to where Robbins is generating leads. And there were more than 1 million people who signed up for this, and most of them attended. And he said, he's cynical. You can read it in the piece. It's on BizNews. But he does conclude with the fact that Robbins spent 3 hours talking, just talking, for 3 days. First day, second day, third day. And then he even had a bonus fourth day where he also spent another 3 hours just talking. And The Economist concludes, whatever he's doing, he's certainly got supercharged energy. So, you know, don't knock it if you like. And closing off with a really sad story from a incredible institution that now seems to be just lurching from one problem to the next. Borge Brenda has been with the World Economic Forum for 8 years. And when Klaus Schwab departed, the founder departed in about a year ago under what appeared to have been fairly trumped up charges, but let's leave that for the moment. Brenda enjoyed the limelight, as it turns out, very briefly. He became the president and the chief executive and basically the main man what counts. And today, the FT has announced that he has resigned. Brenda's gone. And the reason why he's resigned is because he was named as very close to Jeffrey Epstein. In the latest files, hundreds of emails between the two of them, and amongst those emails were conversations on how Epstein really wanted to influence who was invited to the World Economic Forum, to Davos, and Borge Brenda was quite amenable to that. It's a good piece. It reflects deeply on the conspiracy that is now emerging around the predator, the sociopath Jeffrey Epstein, and how he manipulated people who he targeted. And he clearly targeted this guy, who was quite open to being targeted, it seems. Interesting story. Okay, so we really have got quite a lot to get your teeth into today. I'm going to leave it there. Keep an eye on your premium newsletter for links to our freshest published content. Thanks for trusting us with your time. I'm Alec Hogg. Until Monday, cheerio.